Hi, my name's Daryl. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Daryl.
Thank you, Anne, for asking me. Anne asked me first. Thank you for having me, Kim. And thank you all for having me. It's a privilege to be here. I volunteered to get the cake at my first meeting, which was Wednesday night. I'm awfully new here. And on my way over there, I thought I was a little late, so I was in my truck. I thought I was a little late, so I was driving around every curve. I was going, so if my throat's a little scratchy, you'll know why. I'm here to tell you, share with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, or my experience, strength, and hope. Maybe I'll get a little bit of both to you. I'm going to try and kind of gloss over what it was like. I'd like to speak more about recovery, if I can. I was asked about a month ago, and my mind and my ego kept wanting to think about what I was going to say. And every time it happened, well, not every time. I'm bouncing around, aren't I? Whee! Okay, settle down. All right. Every time it would happen, I would realize that I was doing it. And what I realized was that I'm not going to remember what I was thinking anyway. So why bother thinking about it, right? So what I realized was that when I got here, what came out would be what came out. And that I continued to ask God, my higher power, to work through me to share my experience, strength, and hope, and that I would tell the truth. And so I'm going to do that tonight. What I'm going to say and what I'm going to share with you tonight is some of it's personal, and everything that I say is solely my experience. And I don't know anything about Al-Anon, so everything that I say is not to, anything. Anyway, it's solely my experience, right? So what it was like. I was born in San Francisco. I'm sorry, I'll fast forward. The next day, I was born in San Francisco, and my parents were not alcoholics. My grandfather and my grandmother and my great-grandfather and probably my great-grandmother were all alcoholics, but it skipped my mom and my dad. My dad was a rageaholic. He was angry all the time. And my mom, I don't remember much about my mom. She's not really in my memories. I have a memory of my mom when I was in kindergarten. I was taking a bath, and she was downstairs in the basement. And I don't know why I'm sharing this. But I told you what was going to come out was going to come out. And I came downstairs, and she said, "That was really fast. Did you wash yourself? And how much water did you put in there?" I said, "Oh, about that much." And she said, "Go back up and take another bath." And really, it doesn't have anything to do with anything, but I thought I'd share it. So now that I got that out of the way, so anything that I say is not for sympathy. It's not for pity. It's solely to explain the things that happened that got me where I was. So I was molested in the first grade. I was spit on in the seventh grade. I got beat up during busing integration in San Francisco. You know, a lot of negative things, right? We all go through negative things. I went through a bunch of positive things too, but the negative things always weigh heavier, right? I always think that the negative things are what's happening in my head because I choose to, right? They're the thing that I go to, my default. I started drinking in the sixth or seventh grade. I found a Schlitz tall in my hand at a party that my sister brought me to a block from my house. And her and her friends were doing chug-a-lug games, or a chug-a-lug game. And I wanted to be like everybody else. So I grabbed a Schlitz and I started to chug, and I got one sip and felt like I was going to get sick. So The reason I told you about the molestation is because my life was unmanageable before, long before I ever took a drink. Long before. My parents got divorced when I was in the third grade. My mom moved away. So, you know, I had no mom. My dad was teaching, and he was so into his teaching and his female students that I was a latchkey kid. All of us were. And I would walk the streets of the mean streets of Irving and 19th in San Francisco and steal nickels and dimes. And I got started walking up and down. I bounce around. Walking up and down Lincoln Avenue, picking up cigarette butts, and me and my sister would walk into Golden Gate Park and smoke the cigarette butts and kind of get a little buzz. And then anyway, so I get back to the party, and since I felt like I was going to get sick, right, my life is unmanageable. I don't know that, but my life is unmanageable. So I spend the night in the bathroom, so if I get sick from chugging, I'm there, right? I'm planning ahead, right? So that starts my unmanageability in my drinking. I drank like that all the way through my career. I started at 12, I ended at 24. By the time I was 24, I was blacking out, I was waking up in my own vomit, I was using people for, I was using women for sex, thinking I was getting love. Slow down. I had, I had kind of learned to compartmentalize. I was kind of no longer me. And when I was, after my parents got divorced in the city, or before that, there was these two girls around the corner from us. We had the stoop. I don't know if you know what a stoop is, but in San Francisco, we lived in a flat, the upper flat. Then we had the stoop. All the neighborhood kids came around and hung out on our stoop as a front porch with stairs. There was these two girls that lived around the corner, and they lived like on the second or third floor. And I would walk around to their house, and they'd be up there hanging out the window, and I'd be cracking jokes. And, you know, they called me the White Flip Wilson. And I was a happy kid, you know? I was a happy kid. I was telling jokes and cracking up, and they were laughing. And after the divorce, it wasn't like that. And but once I found alcohol, I could laugh again. But what I was laughing at had nothing to do with happiness. What it had to do with was separating myself from the pain. And I could be anything I wanted to. I didn't want to be anything. I just didn't want to be where I was. And it was like that for the rest of my drinking career and even into recovery. I had no... so anyway, I didn't have any... I had no desire to be something, you know? Like, again, I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm just explaining. You know, my dad wasn't around. My mom had left. My dad wasn't around. So I didn't have the extracurriculars at school. Nobody taught me baseball. Nobody taught me football. You know, I had no role models. So I'm on the streets of San Francisco, not learning anything, getting drunk every weekend, and nobody's noticing. I drank for 12 years, 13 years, but while I was drinking in San Francisco, Dad never noticed, right? When Mom moved back to San Francisco, she had a boyfriend in Berkeley. She never noticed. So I got away with everything. I didn't participate in school. I had to go to summer school every year to finish the grade. And that was like that, you know, all through high school. My 10th grade transcript read D, D, C minus F. And then I finally took the proficiency exam and got out of school in 78. I was supposed to graduate in 79. So one of the major, to tell you how bad I was with incomprehensible demoralization, was that I was trying to impress a girl. Her name was Hooter. And I was trying to impress her. I had an empty bindle in one side. And I don't know if it's okay to talk about alcohol or drugs. Is it okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. I had a quarter gram in one pocket, and I had a bindle in the other, empty bindle in the other. And her name was Hooter, and I started saying, Hooter, Tooter, Booter. I got so much cocaine, you know. So I thought I picked up the empty bindle, and I opened it up, and I went like this, and all the coke fell out. I'm on Durant Avenue next to Nation's Giant Burger, right, where all the homeless people go to the bathroom, right? I am so mired in my disease that instead of walking away and letting it go, I got down on my knees and I snorted it up. That's how bad I got. I still didn't see that I was unmanageable. I didn't see anything wrong with it. My friends just watched me. They didn't stop me. My friends just watched me. I was so bad to myself and to others that I didn't know. I didn't care. As long as I got high, I didn't care. Didn't matter. I was in my disease. No, didn't matter who I hurt. I didn't intentionally hurt anybody. I mean, I wasn't a bad guy. You know, I had feelings, I had emotions. You know, I thought I cared about women. You know, I really did. I did care about women. I just didn't know how to. And my disease made it impossible for me to be available in my life as a human being. Because all I wanted to do was get high. All I wanted to do was get high. So kind of what happened was, I got about 45 minutes left, right? Okay, there's no other speakers, right? Did I start at 7?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I knew that I had a problem. I knew it, but I didn't know it. I was in denial. I was in denial. And I went to a family member's 28-day program family night. And after my dad threw a book at my mom, the meeting was over, and one of the female counselors came over, and she put her arm around me, and she said, "You never know, you might be next," with a big old smile on her face. And I kind of went, no, not me, I don't know what you're talking about. But in my heart, I knew, you know, I had a problem. I knew I had a problem. So I knew early on that I had a problem, and I did nothing about it. I wanted to get high. So towards the end, I started getting involved with people that were, I hate to say they were bad news, because that's judging them. And I can't judge them, because I was there, right? It was me. I was there. It wasn't them. So when I talk about this, please remember that I'm not trying to judge somebody else. I'm trying to say that I was there, and that's the reason that this was happening. I got involved with some people that were really tough, and they were dangerous. And I was engaged to this woman, and we were in love. And she broke it off and asked to keep the ring. And it wasn't that great a ring. And one day I rebounded and asked another woman that I had been going out with before if she would marry me. We were driving down the road, and I pulled over. No, she was driving. And I asked her to pull over on the side of the road, just on, you know, by the train tracks. And she pulled over. I got out. I walked around to her, opened up the door, got down on my knee, and said, "Will you marry me?" You know, real romantic, right? Real romantic. I knew how to work. I knew how to be romantic, right? So she said, "Yeah." And we lived together for a little while, and we would go down to the bar and did a lot of drugs and do a lot of drinking. And she was a great woman. She was a great woman. And we actually had a decent relationship, but I was an alcoholic, you know. And I didn't hurt her. I can't say that. All I wanted to do was get high still. So our relationship was going to the bar. That's our relationship. We went to the bar. We didn't have vacations, you know, and most of it was our money. You know, I was, I was a loser. And I'm not beating myself up now. I'm saying what was happening then. So one day, I'm home alone in my shorts, and I had a knock at the door, and my ex-fiance's brother, who's about 6'3", and has been in prison a couple times, and again, I'm not judging, just saying what happened, pushes in the door with a knife in his hand, and says, "Do you have any weapons?" I say, "No," and so he comes in and backs me up into the room. It's a studio, and I had borrowed some money from his sister, and I hadn't paid her back yet. I was going to pay her back the following Tuesday. It was a Friday, something like that. And he didn't want to wait. So he proceeded to gather up all the stuff that was in the apartment and make me carry it out to his car. It was her car. She had driven him there. And I said, "Billy, don't do this." And he says, don't beg me. I'll cut you for bacon." And so he drove away, and I was like, didn't know how to deal with it because I'm not a violent guy. And so anyway, that's what happened. And so about, I don't know how long, but I came home from the bar one night, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I kind of woke up, and I had a spiritual awakening, and I was stone cold sober after drinking and doing drugs, and I just woke up in a crystal clear mind. And it came to me that if I didn't quit drinking, I was going to die. And I knew it in my heart. And the next day, I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had a drink or drug since. I came to Alcoholics a couple times before that. One night, I lived in El Cerrito, and I took a cab over to the San Francisco Salvation Army, and I stayed there for a couple days. But it didn't last more than a couple weeks because I didn't do the program or anything. But this time, I came and I stayed, and that was January 6, 1986. So I haven't had to have a drink or drug since. Thank you. Thank you. So this time I was ready. And when I came in, I had a purpose. I didn't want to live the life that I was living anymore. And I was willing. And I was greeted with smiles. Oh, one of the things that happened, one of the reasons that I was here is because, excuse me, it's a program of attraction rather than promotion. And I worked at a restaurant. I was the morning cook, so I, you know, hungover, come in at 6 a.m., crack eggs, cook bacon. And then the afternoon cook would come in, "Hey, what's going on?" Cracking jokes, you know, having a good time. And I'm like, "Fuck you, you know." Sorry. And I found out a little while later that he had some time in the program. And so it attracted me because he was having fun, you know. He had a good life. And so that's one of the things, one of the reasons that helped to have me have that moment of clarity that I had. So I came in, and I was greeted with smiles and love, and like four or five guys came around me on my first meeting and said, "You know, we're glad you're here, and keep coming back." And all the slogans, you know, get a sponsor, you know, work the steps, 90 meetings in 90 days, easy does it, don't make any changes in your first year, any major changes in your first year, all the slogans. I can't remember them all. There's so many. Knock, 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 knock. I got to go to the bathroom. I did, and I went to meetings. I went to two meetings a day when I was working, and I went to three meetings a day when I wasn't. I wanted to be sober. I was tired. I was dead tired. I was 24 years old when I came in, and I was dead tired. I was tired of waking up and vomit. I was tired of being hungover. I was tired of being, you know, confronted with a knife. I was tired. I was dead tired, you know. I didn't want to live the way I was living anymore. So I got a sponsor, and he took me through the steps. And the first step, he had me write down, I think it was five things that I was powerless over and five ways that my life was unmanageable. And I'm not only powerless over alcohol, I'm powerless over nouns, people, places, and things. For some examples, I'm powerless over the way people drive on the freeway. No, I'm powerless over how what I say affects you tonight. My unmanageability starts when I think that I have some control over what happens when if I try to make something happen with somebody else, if I can make somebody else do something, or I think I'm gonna have to get back to this one. It's not coming to me. So I knew that I was powerless, and I knew that my life was unmanageable. My life was unmanageable because, you know, I didn't lose a house, I didn't lose a job, I didn't lose marriage. I lost two fiancés. I did hurt that woman. We had she had the dress and the invitations and everything. But when I got sober, I realized that I was making a mistake, and if we got married, I was going to hurt her even more. So I think I made the right choice, even though the choice that I made hurt her badly. And I didn't get to make a ninth step to her personally, because I don't know where she is, but I made amends to her in another way. My unmanageability isn't coming to me. So when I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, today for me it's coming to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, because over my years my understanding of my higher power has changed, and it changes sometimes frequently, sometimes slowly, sometimes not at all for a long time. It's been a couple of experiences recently that I'll get to in a little bit that have been major. Anyway, I'm not going to go through all the steps, but I'm going to hit a couple. When we did the third step, we got down on our knees in my apartment, and we said the third step prayer, like it says in the book, and with my sponsor. And we got up, and I was like, wow. I was uncomfortable, right? I was chuckling because it was awkward. You know, I don't have a spiritual or religious upbringing, but it was awkward. So, I felt like nothing happened for a while, like a couple months. And then I went to a meeting one day, and this guy was talking about there was three frogs on a log, and one of them made a decision to jump off. How many frogs were left? I said, oh, two, right? And he goes, no, there's three frogs left on the log because he only made a decision to jump off, right? At the end of the third step, it says, followed by, it's either rigorous or vigorous. I can never remember, but I think it's vigorous, followed by a vigorous course of action. And the vigorous course of action is 4 through 9. So if I don't do 4 through 9, it's very difficult to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. So 4 through 9, and then following it up with 10 through 12 is the way to live a spiritual life with a God that as I understand him. That's my belief. I was having a very difficult time. I've been sober this whole time, but I was dry for some period of that time. I went to meetings and did the program for about 4 years, and then I stopped going to meetings. I met a woman. Go figure. And she wanted to do country line dancing, and since I wanted to be with her, I said yes. So we did that for a couple months. I saw a couple doing this thing called foreplay. It's a West Coast swing dance, and I fell in love. And I started dancing and competing. I have no idea where she is. And I did that for 12 years. I moved to Oregon and wasn't doing the program. And in about 2005, I asked a guy if he would sell me a joint, and he said no, but I'll get you high. And since I didn't want to drive home stoned, I said no thanks. And the next day I went to a meeting, and I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps again. And by the grace of God, I did not accept his offer to get high. By the grace of God, that is the only thing that saved my ass. So I got back into the program. I've been working it ever since. And slowly my life has changed again for the better. I've had a big struggle. I thought moving to Oregon in 97 was going to be a good move. I wanted to move because I wanted the benefits, full-time work, you know, better catch for a marriage so I could settle down, you know. And about 6 months later, both my elbows were bad. I had two surgeries, and then I had another surgery. And I kept thinking after each surgery that, oh, this one will be better, and I'll heal, and I'll do something better. And then after this surgery, I went to school, and you know, that failed. And you know, I kept trying to do God's will, right? And I kept trying to do the next right thing, and it just wasn't working. It wasn't working. And I moved back up here in 2009, and it wasn't working. It wasn't working. And I tried to work in 2015, and my knees got so bad after 5 days, I couldn't work. I couldn't walk. And I kept trying to do, what is your will for me? What is your will for me? And about 2 or 3 months ago, I heard this knock, 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 knock. And there's nobody at the door. I'm sleeping. And I wake up, and I'm screaming in pain. And I wake up, and my window is open, and my neighbor's 25 feet away are very religious. And I say, I'm sorry, I didn't know my window was open. And a couple minutes later, I realized that, you know, I was doing God's will. I was trying to do God's will, and things weren't working out. And I realized that things were working out. They just weren't working out the way I wanted them to. After all these years, I realized that, you know, it sometimes takes a while, right? But it takes what it takes. We all have our lot in life, and we all try our best to take care of it. I tried my best, and it took a long time for it to fit in. But once I peeled away my expectations, you know, my expectations, guys driving slow in the fast lane, my expectation is that he should be in the other lane. It's my expectation, right? It has nothing to do with him. It's my expectation. That's why I get mad. It's my expectation, right? My expectations of other people, they shouldn't be treating me that way. It's my expectation. If I extract myself from that situation, or one more thing and I'll stop. The other day in my closet, I found an old picture of some family, and it was from, I don't know, 92 or something. And I sent it to family members because I thought it would be a cool thing to see. And I got an email from my dad, that's really cool, nice photo. And I got an email from my sister, that's inappropriate that you sent that out, and I'll talk to you about it tomorrow. Right? And I'm like, what? What did I do to hurt you? And so I sent her an email, you know, it's not fair of you to drop a bomb on me and walk away and make me think about this all night, right? So in the past, I'd be like, I wouldn't say anything to her. You know, I didn't have the self-esteem to do that. But working the steps and the program, I have the self-esteem to say, that's not right of you to do that. And so I sent her an email saying that. And I sent another email saying, if you have something to say to me, you should call me. So she called me, and we talked about it, and we worked it out. But she wanted to censor me and tell me that I needed to run the photos by her if it had a photo of her in it. So I have to decide whether do I hurt her by sending emails out, or do I honor her wish to not hurt her by sending the pictures out. So there's extremes. There's good and there's bad, positive and negative. What I have to do is I have to find the balance in everything, and not work in one or the other. Because if I'm in one, I'm dealing all in that. If I'm in the other, I'm dealing all in that. I need to find the balance, so I'm working with less, but it's more because it's easier to deal with. Anyway, I'm rambling. Thank you very much. I really appreciate asking me.